Rourke turned on the lights of the retreat and sloughed out of his parka. He walked down the three steps to the floor of the great room.
I'll get the hot water and everything started.
John nodded. Paul Rubenstein knew the retreat systems as well as he did. Rourke walked across the great room floor, dropping his coat on the arm of the couch. The couch, despite the business with the gunfight between Kurenami and the neo-Nazis, seemed none the worse for wear. Sarah must have been reading his thoughts, a disturbing idea in light of their daughter's singular abilities.
I was able to repair the bullet holes. Just temporary repairs, but I thought you'd want me to. With all the time I'll have here, I can make a permanent job of it.
It's a good old couch.
He sat down on the end nearest the gun cabinets. He could see Paul just past the kitchen and the workroom, inspecting the motorcycles, the old Harley-Davidson lowriders. One day there'd be a time for boarding them again, going out across the land.
I'll get you a drink.
Sarah walked toward the kitchen counter, up the three steps, and leaned against it for a moment.
Are you all right?
Just thinking what I'll make for dinner tonight. Can you stay?
There was no need to consult the Rolex on his left wrist, but out of habit, Rourke did so anyway.
I'd like to more than almost anything. But Darkwood will be moved into the hospital at the German base by now. I have to get back in case Friedrich Rausch strikes tonight.
Sarah poured from one of the duplicate bottles of Seagram 7 whiskey made up for him by the Germans. They produced 1,000 gallons for him. And though the bottles were different, the taste was identical, and the supply would last him a lifetime at the modest rate with which he consumed liquor.
You do have time for the drink, don't you?
Sure.
Rourke noticed Sarah wasn't having one because of the baby. He started to get up, but she was already bringing the glass down to him. She handed him the drink.
Memories, huh?
Sarah smiled, sitting down beside him on the edge of the couch.
I'll be all right here by myself until Annie, Natalia, and Maria arrive. You might want Paul with you.
Rourke set down his drink.
Oh, indeed I would. But I'm not leaving you here alone with Rausch out there. Paul would die for you, just like I would.
Did it ever occur to you that I'd rather have you live for me, John?
What do you mean?
I'm tired of war. Sometimes, and understand how I mean this, but sometimes I think maybe the ones who died were the lucky ones. The ones who died instantly during the night of the war. It's not a death wish. After all we've been through, I'd be an idiot to give up now. It's not that. I just wish things could be different. I don't want our baby to grow up in a world like this. John, I know we've got great expectations for this new alliance with Midwake, but the Russians aren't just going to lie down and die, either. This thing could go on for decades. It's already been going on for 5 centuries, John.
Rourke leaned forward and put his left arm around his wife's shoulders.
But it won't. The Russians under the sea have full nuclear capabilities. If we don't stop this war soon, there won't be a planet left to live on. So it will all be over, one way or the other, rather soon. You can trust me on that. And if we don't win, at least we'll die knowing we tried. I think we're going to win, because we can't let them win. So, Sarah, please, don't worry.
A shiver spread over her. She leaned her head against his chest.
If there's peace...
There's a whole world that's going to need people in it. A world that isn't polluted anymore, isn't overcrowded, doesn't have drug problems. It could be a good world if we make it that. And we will. It'd be easy to be a pessimist, but in a strange way, the world was given a second chance. It'll be up to Michael's children and Annie's and Paul's children and the child you're carrying to make that second chance last forever. They can do it. We just have to keep trying.
I love you, John Thomas Rourke.
John touched his lips to Sarah's forehead. Dinner smelled good. It always did when Sarah cooked, but John wouldn't be eating.
There'll be other dinners, other times.
He smiled as he reflected he had just summarized the bulk of his married life with Sarah. Paul stood beside him at the gun cabinets. John slid back one of the glass doors over the handgun section and took down from a set of wall pegs a gun he sent to New Germany with very specific instructions.
I never had any particular fondness for suppressors when I was with Central Intelligence or otherwise. But recently, I've been noticing an occasional need for a more silent shot, especially with Natalia's Walther unavailable to us. And as much as I'm not a great fan of the 9mm Parabellum, there's something to be said for having a large-capacity pistol available at times.
That's a Smith & Wesson, isn't it? One of the third-generation guns.
Yeah, it's a 6906.
The pistol was about the size of one of Rourke's Detonix miniguns, brushed stainless steel with the black factory grips.
Barrel protrudes past the slide for attachment of a silencer, right?
Rourke smiled. He remembered the Paul Rubenstein of that day at the wrecked aircraft. Paul didn't know one gun from another as they picked through the pile of arms taken from the dead brigand bikers. John armed Paul with the battered old Browning high power and the German MP-40 submachine gun, weapons Paul still carried. Rourke took the suppressor out of a drawer beneath the glassed-in portion of the case. It was black and 8 inches long.
You thread it on just like an ordinary barrel extension, and you lock it into place with an Allen head wrench. The wrench nests in here, in this slot on the side of the unit itself. Just twist and pull it out. Use it to tighten the suppressor once it's threaded on. Then reinsert it in the side here and twist, and the wrench is anchored in place until you need it again to remove the unit. The slide's been fitted with a lock to seal the breech. That's where a lot of the gas escapes and makes noise on pistols that aren't fitted with a lock. I had Colonel Mann's people make me up a batch of subsonic ammunition. The recoil spring was specially modified, the tension reduced, so the pistol would function with the lower energy loads without having to trick up the gun by lightening the slide. Guncrafters used to do that with movie guns sometimes, lighten the slide so the action would cycle with blanks. It's the same idea, basically, but we were able to avoid that. The magazines I have for it all have the feed lips adjusted for the peculiar shape of the bullet itself.
Rourke opened a plain black plastic box and removed one of the special subsonic cartridges. The bullet was coated with a black plastic along the lines of the NICLAD ammunition made by Federal before the night of the war. But the bullet, although a hollow point, was more truncated and longer than conventional 9mm parabellums.
12 rounds in the magazine. After each shot, if you use a slide lock, work the lock down, cycle the action by hand, and raise the lock for the next shot. Without raising the lock, the pistol functions as it normally would, but of course the noise suppression isn't quite as effective. Depends on the situation in which you're using it.
Rourke set the pistol and suppressor down, then looked at his friend.
When Annie, Natalia, and Maria get here, I want you to talk with Annie alone.
John's hands were sweating.
If, in her judgment, Natalia is pretty much all right, then we do as planned. You rejoin me. If there's any doubt in Annie's mind about Natalia's stability under the controlled circumstances here, just have the pilot get a message to me or use the radio. But stay put. The retreat should be as safe as church. That's from the outside. Know what I mean, Paul?
Yeah, I don't like leaving him out here alone, but I don't want to be sitting back here with four women making me hot meals while you're out there either, John. I'll talk with Annie. She's... Natalia, I mean. She's supposed to be all right. I'm close to it, right?
I think so. Well, I pray that she is. I know she wouldn't harm anyone, but she might harm herself. She got to be sure, Paul. If you aren't, then don't come. Stay here. Eat those hot meals until you're sure.
Paul nodded.
You know I will.
Annie should have my note by now.
John began to pack the pistol, the suppressor, the extra baffled material to refurbish the suppressor, the ammunition. He kept his hands busy so he wouldn't have to speak. The suppressor grew slick over its anodizing with moisture from his hands. Annie Rourke Rubenstein felt her eyes widen as she unfolded the message. It was under her door when she returned from visiting Natalia at the hospital. Natalia seemed stronger, happier, every day. Annie set down her purse. She wondered if she'd ever get used to carrying one on a regular basis. And what about high heels? They made her legs feel good because they made her legs look pretty, but they made her feet hurt. She kicked out of them, sinking to the carpeted floor and wiggling her toes. No more did she have her shore patrol guardian angels. She traveled midway as she pleased. With the note in her hand, she crossed the small room and sat on the small window seat, pulling her legs up under her.
Annie, your mother was forced to kill a man named Damien Rausch during the battle here with the Soviets. Rausch was a neo-Nazi. Along with a gang of men, he tried killing Akiro at the retreat. Rausch was the only survivor of that group. Toward the end of the battle at Eden Base, Rausch attempted to shoot Akiro in the back. That's when your mom shot him. There are some complications. Rausch's brother, Friedrich, is about to be in this area and is the likely killer of one of the Eden Project personnel, a woman you may or may not have known, Maritza Zeiss.
Annie remembered her. Very pretty, very smart, and very nice. Someday there'd be a world where Annie might sniff back a tear, but now she was inured to death. She prayed she'd never be used to it. She continued reading her father's radio message.
He also attempted to kill Captain Darkwood. Fortunately, he failed at that. Jason's doing well. Friedrich Rausch is still at large and will attempt to kill your mother unless we can get her to a place of safety. We're doing that until Rausch can be stopped permanently.
She dropped the note onto her lap, her hands shaking. She wiped her hands on her gray skirt and picked up the note and read on.
Paul and I thought your mom would be safe and happier if you and Natalia came to join her. I understand that Natalia's feeling quite a bit better. When you feel that the two of you can join your mom, provided Natalia's willing, notify me through Midway channels. Admiral Ron's office will pretty much know where to find me. Everyone is well here. Michael's been kind of quiet lately. I think he misses Maria. I'm sending a communique to Maria Leuden as well with the same invitation. With four of you in one place, once things settle down, Paul and Michael and I are going to expect a terrific meal, kid. Remember that. Paul's and my love to you, as always, and give my love and Paul's to Natalia as well. Hope to see you soon, honey. Love, Dad.
Annie stared at the piece of paper, then looked out her window at Midwake's artificial sunshine. It would be good to be home. It would be good to be with her mother and Maria. But would it be good for Natalia? Annie looked at the artificial sunlight for a while. All of the old problems that caused Natalia to fall ill in the first place still existed. The fantasy that Natalia's dead husband, Vladimir Karamazov, still somehow lived might never more haunt Natalia, but there were real things enough to drive her back over the edge of reason. More than ever, she knew Natalia loved her father, John Rourke, but it was a love that could never be fulfilled because her father was faithful to her mother. Annie tried to imagine a life where she was in love with Paul, as she always had been, but could not be his. It would be hell. Natalia lived there. John gave the suppressor a good luck twist, then removed the Allen wrench from the body of the suppressor and tightened the suppressor to the Smith & Wesson 6906's extended barrel. Sam Aldridge watched with keen interest.
That's a neat gun, Doctor.
Aldridge touched up the edge of his K-bar-like Marine Corps knife on what passed these days for ceramic sharpening sticks. They sat in the German base hospital's lounge area, an ordinary waiting room with a moderately comfortable sofa and two chairs, a video player, and several magazines. The magazines and the few videos came from New Germany. Other than the language in which the magazines were written, the lounge could have been from any hospital in pre-war America. The waiting room served as the ready room for people on guard at the German base's hospital or those supervising the guard details. John started loading a 12-round magazine for the suppressor-fitted 6906. Every few rounds, he thwacked the spine of the magazine against his palm to more properly seat the cartridges.
What are you going to use that for, Dr. Rourke?
Rourke looked across from the low table at Sam.
I'm not sure, Sam, but when I eventually need it, I'll have it.
The magazine loaded, he inserted it up the butt of the pistol. Then, verifying that the hammer drop safety was lowered, he worked the slide. One other modification to the little pistol, about which he neglected to tell Paul Rubinstein, was the deletion of the magazine safety. A magazine safety on a pistol, Rourke always thought, was just as practical and potentially useful, and as fraught with hazard, as a screen door on the hatch of one of Midway's submarine fleet.
That a Colt?
Rourke smiled.
It's a Smith & Wesson.
I thought they made revolvers, like the one you carry.
Yeah, well, they made these things, too. The barrel and the suppressor are sort of aftermarket items.
Think Rausch will come tonight?
Jason Set got his pistol within reach. We got men outside, men inside. If Rausch comes, he'll have to be damned good to get away.
I mean Jason, Doctor. Is there any chance that...
I know Jason's your best friend, Sam. Sure, there's a chance. But Darkwood knows that. There wasn't any other choice. Rausch won't want to leave Darkwood hanging around to implicate Dodd because evidently he needs Dodd. The Nazis require a base of operations, supply, like that. Lieutenant Kuranami discovered the master computer files aboard the command shuttle were wiped clean. All the locations of the strategic stores laid away for the Eden Project on its return were on those files. Thankfully, Kuranami duplicated them. Now, logic dictates Dodd copied them before wiping them away. Kuranami being possessed of a duplicate set means Dodd doesn't have all the power. I sent Kuranami to the front with Captain Hartman's men. Hartman is Colonel Mann's field commander for the forces covering the Soviet underground city. Hartman's a good officer. I offered that Akiro and Elaine could go into hiding. He wouldn't. There was a war to be fought, he said. Well, Kuranami's that kind of guy. Elaine wanted to stay here. She wouldn't stay with my wife and daughter because if Akiro was going to stay in the thick of things, she had to, too. I talked her into going to Midwake, at least, to help with the war effort there, where her scientific background could be of some assistance. And she should be safe there. Both of their attitudes are admirable, but short-sighted under the circumstances. If Dodd can kill Kurenami or use a lane to get to him, Dodd will have obliterated any chance for the restoration of the computer files except by himself. That's why Dodd's playing footsie with the Nazis. If he can disrupt New Germany, maybe Dieter Byrne and Colonel Mann's people won't be able to help much either. I doubt he cares much for Midwake. Dodd wants to be the only source of help to Eden, so he can control it.
Aldridge put down his knife.
Isn't it kind of dangerous, Doctor? I mean, with the Japanese guy? He could get KIA'd and the files would be lost.
No, they wouldn't be. You see...
Rourke was up, the Smith & Wesson auto pistol shoved into the small of his back, into the waistband of his black BDUs. He closed his fists over the two scoremasters, snatched them up from the table, and stuffed them into his waistband on either side of his abdomen. He caught up his flashlight, and then the M16 he left by the door, and reached for the doorknob. He heard the rattle of the sling from Aldridge's Soviet AKM-96. Sam took it from the battlefield after the Soviet attack on Eden stalled. Rourke noticed a number of the Marines doing the same, preferring it to their issue rifle. It seemed to be a better gun, Rourke had to admit. Rourke stepped into the corridor. A shaft of light washed over the floor from behind him. There was no one visible.
What was it, you think?
Rourke didn't look at Aldridge as he spoke.
Probably nothing. Just her nerves. You check the guards on Darkwood. I'll check by the entrance.
Rourke ran in a long-strided, almost easy, loping gait, holding the M16 in his right fist by the pistol grip. In his left hand, he held the communicator.
This is Rourke. Guard stations. Come back to me in sequence.
Guard stations 1, 2, 3, and 4 reported. There was nothing from guard station 5, near the loading dock, where non-ambulatory patients were brought in for treatment or removed for a flight to better hospital facilities in New Germany.
Guard station 6, come in.
Station 6, roger.
Rourke quickened his pace and changed frequencies so he could contact Aldridge.
This is Rourke. Do you read me, Aldridge? Over.
Loud and clear, Doctor. No problems here. Over.
Guard post 5 on the interior perimeter is not responding. I'm checking it now. Stay alert. Out.
Rourke reached the farthest edge of the perimeter for the remaining modules of the hospital. It was darker here in the corridor, and despite the insulation, cold enough that as he exhaled, he could see his breath. Like small patches of fog in a night intermittently lit by a sliver of moon. Various shafts of light from the corridors and medical facility rooms he passed provided the only illumination. He carried a flashlight in his belt, and merely by using the radio could have contacted one of Aldridge's men or one of the Germans to flick on every light in the building. But he stayed in the semi-darkness. His eyes grew accustomed to it quickly. At times like this, his light sensitivity was a benefit. A blizzard surrounded the enclave. Conditions made it nearly impossible to reach the German base after leaving the retreat. The high winds whipping up the snow were remnants of the dying hurricane from the Gulf. The wind clawed through pinhole-sized apertures and cracks between modular wall segments and roofing. He passed Guard Post 3, the German commando and the American Marine there alert, ready for anything.
Keep a sharp eye out, men.
Rourke ran down the corridor toward the glow of light from Guard Post 4. It was the same there, the American and the German on duty, all as it should be. Guard Post 5 was located near the wards, and to have used his assault rifle near even such a small concentration of people would have been madness. The 5.56mm round would pierce anyone and anything there. He slung the M16 across his back as he ran, left shoulder to right hip, muzzle down. He was better armed for close combat than he had ever been in his life, and close combat it might well be. On the outside of his belt, at the small of his back, in the Ribka MOB holster, was the old 2-inch-barreled Colt Lawman MK3 357 Magnum revolver, loaded with 125-grain jacketed hollow-point 357s. The Smith 629 hung holstered at his right hip. At his left hip, the LS-10 knife. The little Detonics pistols were holstered beneath the weathered brown bomber jacket in the double Alessi shoulder rig. The full-sized scoremasters were in his belt, the A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome hidden inside the waistband of his trousers as well, but at his back. John carried many choices, but he pulled the suppressed 6906 and switched off the safety as he moved out of the light of Guard Post 4. The subsonic bullet wouldn't pass through his target, and silence might prove an advantage. He checked the slide lock. It was lowered, and he left it that way. Not that much silence would be needed, as fast follow-up shots could be important. He kept going, keeping his pace slow and even as he walked into the darkness. And he realized he was afraid. There was always some personal fear in battle. Men who denied experiencing it were either liars or lunatics. But it was not this sort of fear now that gripped him deep in the pit of his stomach, made his hands slightly slick. If something should go wrong, and he should miss this chance, then Roush would be alive to attempt to kill Sarah, kill Darkwood, and aid Commander Dodd in his efforts to turn Eden Base into his personal fiefdom. None of that could be allowed to happen. John stopped walking as he neared Guard Post 5, near enough that he should have seen their light. There was no light to see. He moved closer to the corridor wall. His back to the wall, John Rourke edged forward, keeping his pistol close at his side, his eyes slightly averted lest Roush should attempt to momentarily blind him with high-intensity light. From the darkness ahead of him, he heard a voice.
Doctor, do not move.
Rourke froze, his right fist locked on the butt of the suppressor-fitted 6906.
I am Friedrich Roush, Doctor. I have come to kill your meddlesome friend, Captain Darkwood. Consider the captain's death merely a prelude, an overture to the death of your wife. I will find her. Kill her.
Try killing me, motherfucker.
Rourke dropped to a crouch, nearly on his knees. Unless Roush wore vision intensification glasses, there was no way Roush could clearly see him.
I will kill you, indeed, but only after the most unpleasant murdering of your wife. Sarah is her name, is it not? Death is so much less profoundly felt without the mourning, would you not agree?
John Rourke feared for his wife. He'd experienced fear before, hoped to live to experience it again, but he had never been paralyzed by it. While Friedrich Roush talked, John Rourke moved. He edged back along the corridor toward the nearest open doorway. Rourke dove across the corridor from one side to the other and through the doorway, coming up out of a roll onto his knees. His back hurt him slightly because of the way he moved to avoid the rifle scratching across or banging into the floor and making a betraying noise. He was up to his feet. He knew the aches would stop once he got moving. Because of the modular construction of the base hospital, each block of rooms was designed to connect in a variety of ways for maximum utility. Hence, there were interconnecting doors and demountable walls. John held the suppressor-fitted 6906 tight in his right hand as he moved quickly to the first door, tried it, and opened it. The door opened onto one of the wards housing a half-dozen actual German casualties. As Rourke passed by the nearest bed, he nearly slipped. Rourke took the Zippo wind lighter from his BDU pocket and cupped his hands around it as he rolled the striking wheel under his thumb. He had nearly slipped in a pool of blood. The throat of the man in the bed was slit almost ear to ear. Rourke slowly, soundlessly closed the cowling of the Zippo, extinguishing the blue-yellow flame, his eyes still seeing it as an afterimage as he checked the next occupied bed. Here, too, the man was murdered. The others would be the same, Rourke realized.
Doctor! How does it feel to be so totally helpless to prevent the death of your wife?
Rourke kept moving, across the floor of the ward, toward the demountable wall. He rammed the 6906 into his belt for an instant as he grabbed hold of the locking mechanism, worked it, and unlocked the wall from its frame. Rourke drew the sliding accordion panel back just enough that he could pass through. But he cautiously looked beyond the demountable wall first, because Friedrich Roush had stopped talking. Jason Darkwood sat on the edge of his bed, wondering if he should lie down again. Would he make a more inviting target lying back in his bed, more helpless, more easy prey for this man who killed people in the name of a doctrine at the mention of which sane men were disgusted, filled with revulsion? But he could not lie back. He sat there instead, his left hand beside his pillow. Beneath his pillow lay both the Lancer 2418A2 semi-automatic pistol and his knife. On a practical level, he took great comfort from the gun, a weapon with which he could shoot bullseyes all day long at 25 yards, a weapon he had carried in combat ever since his first days out of the academy. Officers could purchase the issue pistol if they wished, and he very soon purchased his. His second paycheck, he was surprised to remember. The first one he owed most of to two friends who lent him money. By the third paycheck, he was mercifully at sea, and there was no need to spend money for billeting or food. There was times when money was tight in those early days, until he learned to manage it. But the gun always stayed with him. Yet, somehow, he took greater comfort from his knife. It was an identical duplicate, down to the metallurgy of the Randall Smithsonian Bowie his ancestor brought to Midwake. It had heritage, and it was personal. It would be useless at 25 yards, but Friedrich Roush would not come from 25 yards. Roush would be close when and if Roush came. Darkwood's palms perspired. He waited. When Sam Aldridge said, "I'll be back later, Jason, gonna check around some more," Darkwood thought about telling him, "Hey, Sam, don't leave me alone here, huh? I'm spooked." Instead, he told his friend, "I'm fine. Let me know how things are going, okay?" Sam Aldridge left. Now, Jason Darkwood waited alone in the darkness. Rourke was beside a corridor wall. Behind him, a patient lounge. His hearing, always excellent despite his exposure over the years to so much gunfire without the benefit of hearing protection, enabled him now to almost pinpoint the origin of Rausch's voice. This worried him. Why was Rausch being so careless? A thought crossed John Rourke's mind, and the thought chilled him. Cautiously, the pistol in his right fist, Rourke reached out to touch his fingertips to the door handle. Instead, he drew his hand back. Again, he thrust the pistol into his belt and took the Zippo from his pocket. The flashlight would have been easier to use, but easier to spot from the other side of the doorway as well. Rourke shielded the lighter with his body to muffle any noise as he struck a flame. He dropped to a crouch beside the doorway, moving the lighter close to the handle. Leading out of the handle's base were two thin pieces of wire. Turning the door handle would bridge the wires. Rourke's lighter and his eyes followed the wires down to the base of the door, then along the base molding and along the wall. The wires ended at the wall outlet. If he had opened the door without thinking, he would have electrocuted himself. John smiled. Rausch had retaught him a valuable lesson. Never underestimate an enemy. John unsheathed his LS-10 knife and went to work on the wires. Jason Darkwood lay in the bed.
Calm down, Jace. You're making up noises. Nothing's gonna happen. There are two United States Marines on duty at the end of the hall, and all of the connecting doors are blocked and locked.
He could hear the wind. His room opened onto the central courtyard for the hospital. Dr. Munchen had explained the reasoning behind the hospital layout.
We have always felt that psychological well-being is a great contributor to physical well-being. Often, a chance to experience the sunlight, the fresh air, a pleasant breeze can be quite therapeutic. With the modular construction of our field hospitals, it is very simple to merely leave out a center module or even several, thus creating a central courtyard in which recuperating patients can experience a natural environment. Statistics indicate as high as a 5% reduction in overall hospitalization in hospitals using this technique, among a certain class of patients, of course. I feel its validity can best be tested against the opposite extreme. Here in American Georgia, of late, the climate is so extreme that patients, no matter how otherwise hardy, cannot be exposed to the cold and the snow. Periods of hospitalization based on preliminary raw data with comparative wounds to comparative personnel are of greater duration. But perhaps the snow will stop.
This was Darkwood's first truly prolonged experience on the surface, and the severe weather astonished him. That men constantly lived and worked and fought with such conditions of extreme cold, high winds, and falling snows was a testimony to their character and their endurance. Darkwood smiled. He imagined a surface dweller would have marveled equally at the adaptability shown by Midwake personnel to a life... How could he classify the life of Midwake? Enclosured? One was almost always enclosed beneath the great domes of Midwake itself, within the hull of one of Midwake's vessels. Only a very few ever escaped enclosure, albeit for a brief period of time. Even swimming as part of a mission rarely took someone to the surface, and while swimming, one wore helmet and suit and worked encased from head to toe, even the hands. Suddenly, Jason Darkwood wanted to be in the cold, feel the wind, the snow. He stood up a little too quickly and held on to his nightstand. Here he was a prisoner, really, enclosed within the walls of this room, within the larger confines of the building itself. There was a door leading to the outside, but logic dictated staying put. Prisoners of ice and snow and wind and prisoners of the sea were very much alike. The scratching was against the outer door leading to the courtyard. It wasn't like any of the sounds he heard before, the howling of the wind, the creaking of the very building joints themselves at times. Darkwood took up his pistol, stared at it. Was it Rausch come to get him? He tightened his right fist on the butt of the Lancer 2418A2. He wished he had some sort of missile at his command instead of just a pistol. Jason edged back from the door to the outside. He crossed the room toward the door leading to the corridor. Was it merely the fact that it was outside, beyond that door, that somehow, on an almost primordial level, terrified him? He had his hand reaching out for the door handle leading to the corridor, to an inside place, enclosed. Darkwood stopped moving his hand. If he touched that door handle, he would be giving in to the fear, strengthening its grip on him. He would be giving in to the fear of being stalked by Roush, trapped in an unfamiliar environment, one of unbridled hostility. His head and neck ached, and medication for the pain coursed through his system. Darkwood thrust his left hand into the pocket of his robe so he couldn't reach for the door handle. He knew enough about the human body to know that things like fear and confidence were controlled by chemical triggers. Some chemical trigger, it had to be the medication, was tying him in knots of indecision, but he could start other chemical triggers working. Brave men conquered their fear because they had no choice, not because they wanted to. Jason had no choice. Jason started walking, slowly, because he couldn't walk rapidly, toward the door to the outside. If Friedrich Rausch was waiting for him, then the thing would get over with quickly, one way or the other. Darkwood gripped the pistol tighter. It was a tape player. Not modern, like those of New Germany, but state-of-the-art for the era of John Rourke's earlier life in the 20th century. It was from one of the Eden Project supply caches.
You must know, Doctor, that you cannot win. Ours is a historic struggle. I know when you were born. What a pity. I feel terrible sorrow for you that you were born only after the great hero of humanity was sacrificed on the altar of mediocrity. A sacrifice to the demagogues of the self-styled democracies. To have lived in those days when Der Führer walks the earth like mortal men, and to have breathed air that might have touched him.
Rourke pushed the button for stop. Friedrich Rausch was smarter than Rourke's appraisal of the man's capabilities suggested. Somewhere along the corridor, there would be a photoelectric eye or pressure-sensitive strip. John Rourke, having passed through or on whatever it was, activated the tape play mechanism. Rausch intentionally came here, to the most remote of the interior perimeter outposts, and killed. Near Rourke's feet, as he shone the light, were two bodies, throats slashed ear to ear. One body, that of an American Marine from Midwake, the other, that of a commando of New Germany. John took the cassette from the recorder. Something, some random sound in the background, anything, might prove of some use. Then he ran. Because Friedrich Rausch would be at the heart of the hospital complex, ready to kill Jason Darkwood, if Darkwood weren't dead already.
Oh, Jesus.
Jason Darkwood's head ached with the movement. Dr. Munchen told him to expect some pain, even some disorientation under mental or physical stress. The blow to his head had been severe. He was feeling vaguely nauseated. Darkwood's palms sweated. He felt pain and seemed disoriented. And there was a chemical reaction going on in his body that was making things worse. He touched his left hand to the locking bolt on the door, leading to the outside, to the snow-drifted courtyard. He slid the bolt back. He gripped the door handle with his left fist. His right fist tightened on the butt of the 2418A2.
Open the door. It's only a door. It'll be a little cold. That's all right. Anything out there, I blow it away with this.
He held the pistol close by his right side. He turned the door handle. The door was stuck. Darkwood tugged at the door. A cold sweat broke over him. He grew dizzy. He pulled harder.
Whoa!
The icy wind almost knocked him down as it swirled inside his hospital room. Snow rose in a drift several feet high beside where the door had been. It formed a flange there now, at the base and on the left-hand side of the doorframe as well, sculpted flat and smooth.
Anybody out there?
On the run, Rourke reached the center of the corridor and clicked on his communicator.
He can hear us, Sam. Hear us, and I'd lay money on it. He can hear every word we say. He's closing in on Darkwood right now if he hasn't gotten him already.
My two Marines, that motherfucker, they're not answering.
Dead. One Marine and one German commando dead on post five and probably more between there and Darkwood's room. Oh, he's good. He's so good he's scary. But we're gonna get him. You hear that, Rausch? We're gonna nail your ass!
Jason Darkwood stood in the doorway's threshold, his left hand balled into a fist to keep his robe closed at his throat. His entire body trembled with cold and the dizzy feeling in his head.
I know you're out there! You want to kill me? Then come ahead, you crazy bastard!
Darkwood stepped through the doorway. If Friedrich Rausch had access to one recorder, he had access to many. He probably knew the first recorder would be discovered, but he might assume no one would guess he'd use a second tape recorder in the same way. Rourke punched through the doorway into the vacant patient room across the central courtyard from Darkwood's room. Rourke ran to the window and pushed back the curtain. Jason Darkwood stood shivering in the snow just outside the open doorway leading from his room. Darkwood looked disoriented. It could be a reaction of adrenaline with the medication Dr. Munchin administered to aid in Darkwood's recovery. At the edge of the shaft of light flooding over the snow through the open doorway, inside the room, behind Darkwood, lurked the figure of a man. Rourke couldn't risk a shot. He looked to his right and saw a sliding hospital bed table. He grabbed it, resting it free of the bed with his right hand as he reached with his left hand for the door handle. He could hurtle the table through the open doorway into the courtyard to distract. Rourke almost touched the door handle.
What?
He stopped and grabbed the flashlight from his belt, letting the table rest against the wall. John dropped to a crouch beside the door handle. In the beam of the flashlight, he saw the wires, the same as before, with their obvious invitation to cut them. But, tracing them to the nearest outlet, Rourke saw another set of wires. The first set, a blind.
Clever Nazi.
As he moved, his right foot slipped a little. He played his light over the floor and found a puddle of water, a wire set in its center. He followed the second collection of wires back toward the door handle. If he cut the first and obvious set, the second set would get him.
I haven't got time, you son of a bitch.
John shoved the flashlight into his belt, raised to his full height, and swung the M16 forward on its sling. He could see Darkwood turning around as the shadow of the man who stalked him obscured a portion of the shaft of light in which Darkwood stood. The M16 blasted through the synthetic transparent panel serving as a window to the courtyard, blowing it out in huge jagged chunks so he could scramble through without ripping his clothing and the flesh beneath it to shreds. Darkwood was already wheeling toward the sound of gunfire, but not toward the shadow. The M16 empty, Rourke let it fall to his side on its sling. He quickly drew the 6-inch barreled .44 Magnum revolver at his right hip. The figure stepped out of the shadow, fully backlit now, a sinister silhouette with some sort of crossbow shouldered and ready to fire. The figure ducked left as Darkwood, apparently alerted by some sound or some movement, turned toward him. The crossbow flew from the figure's right hand and the form fell back. Rourke's shot missed the intended target, the figure's center of mass. Darkwood fired his pistol. The muzzle flashed a quick tongue of flame that endured for only an instant. There was an answering flash from inside the room, and Darkwood stumbled back, fell into the snow as John vaulted through the shot-out window and into the courtyard. Darkwood was up on his elbow, firing the pistol again as Rourke reached him.
It was Rourke! It had to be!
John heard the slamming of a door from inside.
Get inside if you can! I'll send help!
Rourke switched on his earpiece.
Sam! This is Rourke! Rausch is in the corridor outside Darkwood's room. He tried and missed. He's armed. Get help to Darkwood. He's making his way back to his room from the courtyard.
Rourke didn't wait for an answer. He ran through the doorway into the room, his clothes wet with snow from the brief seconds outside in the courtyard, the 629 in his right fist. Rourke crossed the room in two long strides, grabbed up a chair from near the bed, returned to the open doorway, and threw the chair through into the corridor. Automatic weapons fire tore through the seat back, almost severing the chair in two before it hit the corridor floor. Rourke stabbed the 629 through the doorway and emptied the remaining five rounds from the cylinder in the direction from which the gunfire came. He dropped the 629 into the Sparks holster and drew both Detonic Scoremasters, thumbing back the hammers as he went through the doorway, firing both pistols as he crossed the corridor to the doorway opposite, but slightly nearer the origin of the gunfire. Chunks of wall and doorframe sprayed around him, and he squinted against the cloud of debris.
Ah, damn it.
There was something in his right eye. He blinked both eyes as he looked down at his pistols. They each held four rounds. He backed deeper into the doorway, blinking his eyes to clear the right one. Rourke stabbed both pistols toward Rausch's position, firing them out. Another hail of automatic weapons fire tore into the doorframe. John thrust both pistols into his belt, the slide still locked open over the empty magazines. He grabbed the Colt Lawman from the Ribka MOB holster at the small of his back and fired the snubby .357 Magnum blindly down the corridor. He blinked his eye, encouraging tears. Finally, the offending bit of building material was gone. Rourke grabbed his flashlight, flicked it on, and stared into the light with his right eye, making the tears flow freely.
Son of a bitch!
Rourke stuffed the lawman into the right hip pocket of the black BDU pants he wore. He reached for the little Detonics Combat Masters under his armpits, ripping the miniaturized stainless steel .45s from the double LSE rig. The return fire sounded light enough to be a 9mm submachine gun. Rourke shifted the pistol in his right hand to his left, both of the little .45s held uselessly there for a moment, as he pulled the magazine from the M16, stuffed the empty in a front pocket, then snatched a fresh 30-round spare from his musette bag. He rammed it home, pressuring his hip against the wall to lock the rifle in place as he worked the bolt, jacking a round into the chamber. Rourke shifted one of the little combat masters back to his right hand. He fired both pistols out, keeping them in the open a split second too long so that Roush would realize they were empty. Again, John Rourke had planned ahead. Roush must be thinking that no rational man facing an opponent armed with an automatic weapon would respond with pistol fire if he had another option. Rourke shifted the Detonic's combat master from his right hand to his left. He closed his right fist over the M16's pistol grip, thrust the Colt assault rifle out tight against the sling. Rourke stepped into the corridor as Friedrich Roush disappeared around the bend at its far end. Rourke's fire took a chunk out of the corner of the corridor. Roush staggered for a split second before he ran on. John ran after him.
I'll get you, you crazy bastard.
Jason Darkwood raised the leg of the hospital bed, kicking the inverted kidney-shaped bedpan in place beneath it. He dropped to his knees, shaking with fear. If adrenaline did it to him, reacted chemically with the medication Dr. Munchen prescribed, then more adrenaline would undo it, he hoped. He inserted a fresh magazine up the well of the 9mm Lancer caseless, put the fingers of his left hand beside the bedpan, and closed his eyes. With the edge of his hand, he slammed the bedpan away, letting the leg of the bed crash down on his fingers. Jason Darkwood almost screamed with the pain as he sprawled on his back, his hand still trapped beneath the leg of the bed. He shook his head. The adrenaline rush came. He could feel the nausea replaced with pain. He struggled to his knees, threw his body weight against the bed frame, and lifted up with his right hand, freeing his left hand. His fingers didn't move. He didn't care.
No more piano for me.
Oh. Darkwood picked up his pistol, his knife already sheathed in his pistol belt around his waist. He rose to his feet, stumbled, nearly collapsed over his bed. The pain grew so intense that the nausea was returning. But the fear that slowed his reflexes, dulled his senses, nearly paralyzed him, the fear was gone. Jason stumbled for the door, his throbbing left hand useless at his side, his right fist tight on the butt of the 2418A2. Rourke reached the bend in the corridor. The M16 extended ahead of him like a magic wand against death.
It's me! Rourke! Shout, or I'll shoot!
Holy shit! He blew out the damn wall! You okay, Doctor? Doctor! Doctor!
Yeah! I'm all right! Just get the bastard!
Rourke staggered through the building debris toward the doorway and into the partially collapsed corridor. As Rourke edged forward, he could see the wall at the bend of the corridor. There was a hole in it large enough to drive his pickup through on his way to the retreat. Friedrich Roush was gone. On the floor, gleaming in the rubble, were dozens of empty brass cartridge cases. Rourke bent over, picking up several of the shell casings for analysis. Each type of firearm from the period before the night of the war bore a distinctive firing pin indentation, as discernible to the careful observer armed with examples of firing pin indentations as a fingerprint, and just as unique. Rourke kept such examples at the retreat. If time allowed and circumstances dictated, he could match the indentation on these samples to the appropriate firearm type. Uzi, Steyr, Heckler & Koch, etc. If he encountered such a weapon again, he could likely determine whether or not this specimen was the exact gun from which the case was ejected, providing, of course, that the firing pin hadn't been changed. Other markings as the case was ejected could be of use as well. Visible through the hole were Aldridge and a half-dozen men, a mixed force of U.S. Marines and German commandos, running into the snowy night. Jason Darkwood leaned heavily against the corridor wall, holding his pistol in his right fist, his left arm limp at his side.
What happened to you? Oh, Lord, what happened to your left hand?
I figured if adrenaline screwed me up, more of it might burn the medication out of my system completely. I dropped a leg of the bed on my hand, Doctor, but it worked.
The medical rationale was a bit dicey, but the principle seemed to have been sound enough in application, Rourke observed.
Oh, God, my head's killing me. My neck feels like somebody's standing on it, but I'm not shaking. My stomach isn't doing flip-flops, and I'm in control again.
Rourke nodded, looked out into the snow, then turned his attention to Darkwood's hand. As gently as he could, Rourke began to examine it. Three fingers were broken, one in two places.
Sam and his men won't get Roush. God help us now.
How is the child who was with me? I must know.
The German in the white laboratory coat with the stethoscope hanging at his throat looked at Vasily Prokopyev and smiled.
She is in good health, all things considered. In good health. With care, she will be well. Where did you find this child?
I must talk with Dr. John Rock.
Where have you heard of the doctor, young man?
I have a message for Dr. John Rock.
You have not asked about your own health.
That does not matter.
I will speak to my commanding officer. Perhaps you could tell him the message.
The man smiled. Prokopyev shook his head. The motion hurt and he felt slightly sick.
I must speak with Dr. John Rock. It is very important that I speak with Dr. John Rock. Oh, I can speak with no one else. You must contact him.
The doctor is a very busy man, young fellow.
I am Vasily Prokopyev, Major of Elite Corps, Committee for State Security of the Soviet. I have important documents for Dr. Rock. Only for Dr. Rock.
You were searched, young man, and there were no documents found on your person. You have had a serious time of it. Perhaps things will be clearer for you when you have rested. We will talk again then.
Prokopyev tried sitting up as the doctor introduced the hypodermic needle into his arm.
Dr. Rock! I must see Dr. Rock. It is very important that I give my message to Dr.
Michael Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, and John Rourke joined Dr. Munchen, Sam Aldridge, and Colonel Wolfgang Mann in Jason Darkwood's hospital room. Sarah Rourke watched her son and her husband intently. Except for the touches of gray in John's hair and the subtle differences in attire and weapons, John and Michael could have been twin brothers rather than father and son. Their personalities were clearly identical as well. John took instant command of the meeting he called, out of deference to Darkwood here at the hospital.
I'll come right to the point, Sarah, gentlemen. Friedrich Rausch, I badly underestimated him. Not badly enough that Commander Darkwood got killed, but badly enough that personnel from both Midwake and your command, Colonel, were killed. This man is very good at doing bad. And at least this time he proved too good for me. He's on the loose, with help from Dodd, most certainly. Part of Rausch's agenda doubtlessly includes finding you, Sarah, and killing you. That's a given. But you should be safe at the retreat.
Sarah felt her blood run cold as John's words faded in the howl of the blizzard. Friedrich Rausch cupped his hands around the lighter and lit a cigarette. If his deceased brother Damien had a message for him, he knew where he would find it, and he set to work.
Hold the light closer, Commander Dodd.
Friedrich Rausch took the skinny-bladed commando knife and made an incision along his brother's abdomen, then began to lay back layers of skin and muscle. A cigarette hung from the right corner of his mouth. He squinted against its smoke.
God, I can't watch this.
Then close your eyes, Dodd.
Rausch cut through grayed and frozen tissue, at times sawing. Finally, he exposed the colon. He cut through it. His fingers, stiff and numb in the rubber gloves, his brother's corpse radiating cold, Rausch searched, cut, and searched, until, at last, he found a tiny synthetic capsule. With the butt of his knife, he cracked the frozen surface of the water in the dish on top of his brother's chest and dropped the capsule into the water. He spit the cigarette butt onto the floor.
I knew he would not die without leaving me the means by which to continue our work.
A true feeling of pride filled Rausch over his brother's devotion and foresight.
I am at a loss, Dr. Rock. I would feel more comfortable were I able to post troops surrounding the retreat to protect the women inside. But obviously, setting guards in the area would serve to alert attackers.
One of us could stay with them.
Sarah stood up.
We will be fine. Nobody can get inside the retreat without using explosives or a cannon, right? So we'll be fine. One big pajama party.
She tried using language she felt the men would understand, and when John looked at her, she knew he understood very well. Lieutenant Horst Hammerschmidt swung up into the saddle and nodded to his sergeant, Kasimir Schlabrendorf. Mount up! It was the kind of beautiful mountain morning that made it very difficult to remember there was a war going on. and that enemy forces, those of the Soviet, lingered in the mountain passes, in high valleys, and in jungles below, harassing New Germany's efforts around the globe. Periodically, Horst would remind his men of their commitment, as he had this morning after breakfast before the tents came down.
The long-range Mountain Commandos Group mission is to ferret out the small units of elite corps personnel, thereby safeguarding the air corps of New Germany from surface to air missile attack. We enable the German people to prosecute war against the Soviet Union and to assist their allies. You all know our mission, and I would never say that one of you ever forgets it. This unit has one of the best effectiveness ratings of any unit operating within the long-range Mountain Commando group. But still, Soviet surface-to-air missiles bring down or disable an average of 3 aircraft every 5 days. I would never say you do not try hard enough, but we all must try harder!
He kept the number of his lectures to a minimum and made them as short as possible. Most of his men were a little better than grown boys when he took over the unit. They were used to long, boring parental lectures, alternated with long and boring lectures from professors and military instructors. The last thing they needed was another father or teacher. Horst's older brother Otto instilled early in him the idea that men, especially the highly trained volunteers who earned the right to be called commandos, followed the example set for them by their leader, more so than any words. Horst adopted that philosophy of leadership as well. He never ordered his men to do something he would not do himself or had not already done. The philosophy worked. Some of the older military officers, men the age of Colonel Wolfgang Mann and above, but with less wisdom than the brilliant Mann, theorized that with the dissolution of the old order and the introduction of true republican democracy to New Germany, there would be a breakdown in military discipline. The opposite proved to be the case. The men fought now not for the leader, but for New Germany. And New Germany was their home for all the generations since the war between the two American and Soviet superpowers 5 centuries ago. Their wives, their sweethearts, mothers and sisters, all these lives were theirs to protect or squander. And no man Horst Hammerschmidt had known showed any desire to shirk such responsibility. Horst's mount trembled beneath him, and he let the animal out into a canter for a few yards. Horse and rider wheeled, and he clapped the animal on the neck.
Easy, Rommel. Easy, lad.
The horse's head shook as though he understood, and Horst Hammerschmidt would have wagered any man that Rommel did. Sunlight streaked through a notch in the granite fortress walls of the mountains. The notch formed a pass in the higher altitudes toward which they would ride this morning, and the sunlight bathed Rommel's pale gray coat yellow. Horst rose in his stirrups.
The men are mounted and ready, Herr Lieutenant!
Schlabrendorf saluted, holding it as Horst Hammerschmidt glanced along the column of twos. He returned the salute.
Order the men to move out in column of twos!
Yes, Herr Lieutenant!
Hammerschmidt lowered the salute. Schlabrendorf did likewise.
In columns of twos! Forward!
The long-range mountain commandos, their woodland camouflage uniforms as crisp as to be expected after already spending 9 days in the field, their assault rifles slung across their backs, their saddles creaking, their horses looking as if somehow they were in a great hurry this morning, passed him nearly to the last rank. Then Horst gently kneed Rommel. A slight tug to the left rein, and his animal fell into the column's left flank, moving ahead easily. Steam rose from Rommel's nostrils. Already, Hammerschmidt felt the warmth of the saddle's back through the split in the saddle's tree. Leather boots and leather stirrups dully gleamed. The hoarfrost's gray shone almost white against the near black of Rommel's forelegs. Rommel shook his head, settling into the pace of Sergeant Schlabrendorf's big gray mare.
A beautiful morning, Schlabrendorf.
Yes, sir, Lieutenant. Very beautiful. But very cold for my old bones, I think.
Horst clapped Schlabrendorf on the back. There was something in the air today. The animals felt it. So did he. For some reason, he touched at the flap of his belt holster for the reassurance of his pistol there.